Attacking cultural decadence in Germany went further than an attack on Americanism. Socialism, Marxism, Bolshevism, liberalism, and democracy could all be co-opted into the critique of modern society. And there was an unmistakable racial dimension. It was easy to portray Jews, prominent in cultural life and the mass media, as the chief purveyors of the modern asphalt culture of the big city. The antithesis of the true German culture, embedded in the blood and soil of the countryside. Hopes of creating a new elite could also gain strength amid the cultural pessimism, which provided fertile ground for the cultivation of ideas of national regeneration through eugenics and racial hygiene. The First World War and the dramatic changes that it had unleashed had heightened greatly the sense of lost values and cultural decline. The losses suffered in the war sharpened in particular the worries about falling birth rates, much commented on and widely felt as a threat to the family, the values it represented, and to the virility of the nation. War invalids with missing limbs and the sight of young widows grieving for husbands killed at the front seemed to symbolize the demographic dangers for the nation's future. Not just declining birth rates, but also the quality of the population preoccupied influential figures in the medical profession and promoted ideas of eugenics. It was not a German peculiarity. The Eugenic Society in Britain, founded in 1926, quickly gained about 800 members, mainly from elites in science, culture, and politics, who were obsessed with the biological improvement of the population and whose influence ran beyond their numbers. Eugenics societies existed also in Scandinavia, Spain, the Soviet Union, and elsewhere. Sterilization of mental patients to improve the quality of the population and to save money at the same time was mooted beyond German borders. A Swedish Institute for Racial Biology had been founded, for example, in Uppsala in 1922. But the obsession with racial quality was nonetheless especially marked in Germany. As early as 1920, a criminal lawyer, Karl Binding, and a psychiatrist, Alfred Hocher, had mooted what was then still the extreme view of a small minority, that the destruction of life not worth living should be legally permitted. The emphasis on quality rather than quantity in the composition of the nation is psychologically connected with the reduction in our food-producing area, it was claimed in an address to the German Association for Psychiatry in 1925, linking population policy with a lack of living space, Lebensraum, a term later associated with Nazi ideology. 2 years later, the declining German birth rate was described as the most fearful of the many symbols of the decline of our culture, brought about by the victory of the city over the peasantry and the emancipation of women, and bound to lead eventually to the fall of the white race. Highly influential in promoting cultural pessimism was Oswald Spengler's Der Untergang des Abendlandes, The Decline of the West, the first volume of which had appeared in 1918, just before the end of the war, and the second 4 years later. Spengler's laboriously developed comparison of historical cultures used a biological analogy of life cycles to argue in somewhat mystical terms that Western culture was condemned to decline under the impact of materialism, which could only be combated by the power of a strong state united in the hands of an elite. The German middle classes had bought more than 100,000 copies of the convoluted work by 1926. Easier reading than Spengler, but again promoting the mood of cultural pessimism and exploited by the political right, was Hans Grimm's 1926 novel Volk ohne Raum, People Without Space, which implied that overpopulation was at the root of Germany's economic woes and could only be overcome through a struggle for existence to conquer new land, while touching on nostalgia for empire he envisaged as being in Africa. The novel sold over 200,000 copies between 1926 and 1933, many, no doubt, to supporters of the growing Nazi movement. Only a relatively small minority of Germany's population of 60 million were avid readers of Spengler or Grimm. Nonetheless, the influence of such writers and others with opportunities to expound their views in newspapers or other publications, or, like clergymen and schoolteachers, serving as multipliers of opinion, shouldn't be underrated. Nor should their potential to shape attitudes that could later be popularized by fascism. Most of the German population was old enough to recall, if often with distorted, wistful memory, what seemed increasingly, with the passage of time, a wonderful era of peace, prosperity, and civilization that had been destroyed by the war, leaving a disastrous, chaotic aftermath. In the eyes of cultural pessimists, only the shadow of former glory remained, and to them, what was left of European civilization and the values of the Christian West, Abendland, was imperiled not just by decadence within, but by importing external moral and political disease. There's little doubt about the nature of their paramount anxiety, the existential threat from the potential spread of Bolshevism throughout Europe and, above all, its corrosive effect in Germany itself. Cultural pessimism was more widespread and acute in Germany than anywhere else in Europe. No other state was as riven with anxiety about national decline, though France ran it close, and few, if any, countries were devoid of cultural pessimists. The manifestations of cultural pessimism in Germany indicate that in the most important and advanced country in Central Europe, ideas were being articulated even during the Golden Twenties, which could become a potent force in a drastically changed political and ideological climate. That time had not yet arrived. Cultural pessimism and its ancillary trends were still a minority taste. But that would all alter with the onset of the Great Depression. Bright prospects? The acceptance in 1924 of the Dawes Plan opened the door to a potential new basis of relations between France and Germany. This formed the crux of all hopes for Europe's lasting security. The new British Foreign Secretary, Austen Chamberlain, whose aloof, austere figure in morning coat, complete with top hat, carnation, and monocle, made him, if unfairly, appear a mere caricature of the English upper class, voiced the hope in January 1925 that a new Europe could be built on foundations that may give peace and security to the nations of the old world. The hope seemed realistic. The key to European stabilization was to overcome the inherent blockage posed by the incompatibility of German demands for revision of the Versailles Treaty and French insistence on impenetrable security against any further aggression from their neighbour east of the Rhine. Chamberlain was to be an important broker in putting Franco-German relations on a new footing in 1925-26. Britain's global interests, involving costly defence expenditure, especially on the Navy, to protect overseas possessions, required the diffusing of tensions in Europe, which meant establishing some sort of equilibrium between France and Germany. But the two main players in reordering relations were Chamberlain's counterparts in those countries, their foreign ministers Aristide Briand and Gustave Stresemann. Briand, eloquent, charming, a cigarette invariably on his lips beneath a bushy moustache, was the archetypal French diplomat and a statesman of vision. Even contemplating at such an early juncture a future European Federal Union independent of American power, Briand recognized that French interest lay in marrying the indispensable need for security with a rapprochement that could form the basis of lasting peace and prosperity for both France and Germany. His difficulty was in persuading French public opinion that any rapprochement with the old enemy wouldn't undermine security. The German Foreign Minister, Gustav Stresemann, a solid figure in appearance, his face slightly porcine, with a thin moustache and balding head, a forceful, ambitious, imposing personality, was equally far-sighted in looking to secure foundations of lasting peace in Europe. He had at one time been a fervent monarchist, and, during the war, a pronounced annexationist. But the conflict, Germany's post-war experience, and the traumatic year of 1923, during part of which he had been Reich Chancellor, had convinced Stresemann of the need to place relations with France on a new footing if his professed aim of a peaceful Germany at the centre of a peaceful Europe was to become a reality. The new Germany and its recovery, he told the conference of the German People's Party in 1926, can only be based on peace. But how will this peace be possible, he asked, if it isn't founded on an understanding between Germany and France? Stresemann was both a shrewd pragmatist and an unremitting nationalist. There was no contradiction. Crucial to him was the need to re-establish Germany's predominance in Europe. But Germany was diplomatically isolated and militarily weak. To make German re-ascendancy possible, the restoration of the country to full equality of great power status alongside Britain and France, leading to a revision of Versailles and solution of the reparations question, was the absolute prerequisite. It could be obtained, in his view, only through peaceful negotiation, which meant rapprochement with France. Like Briand in France, Stresemann had his hands full in keeping at bay the sizable and aggressively critical parts of the nationalist right, who were demanding a more assertive foreign policy. But for 5 years, he managed it. The decisive step in establishing Franco-German détente was the Treaty of Locarno, signed on the 16th of October 1925. The terms had been negotiated by Stresemann, Briand, and Chamberlain on board the Orange Blossom during a 5-hour boat ride on Lago Maggiore. Germany, France, and Belgium undertook not to attack each other. Great Britain and Italy stood as guarantors. The central component was a guarantee by the five powers of Germany's western borders and the demilitarized zone of the Rhineland. The treaty paved the way for Germany's accession to the League of Nations in 1926, while the improved international relations created by the spirit of Locarno offered hope among West Europeans for lasting peace. The French were happy that Britain was now formally guaranteeing their security. For Briand, this was the vital gain. Britain welcomed the détente and the confinement of its future responsibilities in Europe to the Rhine frontier. For Stresemann, Locarno was a necessary step towards a longer-term goal of German resurgence. With diplomatic isolation removed, the prospects of bringing about the early withdrawal of Allied troops from the demilitarized zone in the Rhineland, scheduled for 1935, were brighter. Beyond that, it might now prove possible to win back Eupen-Malmedie from Belgium, acquire the Saar again, ease reparations and end Allied military control in Germany. The loss of Alsace-Lorraine had to be accepted, it was true, but Stresemann pointed out that this was an inevitable corollary of German military weakness. And he had conceded nothing on the question of Germany's eastern borders. Each of the Western powers had grounds for satisfaction in the outcome of Locarno. In Eastern Europe, the response was different. Poland in particular felt let down by the Western powers, especially by its ally, France. Poland's position was significantly weakened, the country more isolated than it had been, precariously squeezed between the Soviet Union and Germany. There had been no Eastern Locarno. Germany had explicitly ruled out any guarantee for Poland's frontiers. Neither Britain, which wanted no engagement in Eastern Europe, nor France, despite its alliances dating back to 1921 with Poland and with the little Entente of Czechoslovakia, Romania, and Yugoslavia, had strong enough motives to insist upon such a guarantee. Both had greater interest in binding Germany more closely to the West and ruling out any likelihood of its strengthening ties with the Soviet Union, advocated by some voices in Germany, recalling the merits of the Rapallo Treaty of 1922, which had established flourishing trading relations, as well as hidden military cooperation, of significant benefit to both countries. Germany's strident nationalists were predictably unhappy with Locarno. Stresemann himself sought to assuage his right-wing critics by leaving open the question of correcting the eastern frontiers, with a prospect that at some point Danzig, the Polish corridor, and Upper Silesia would return to Germany. He gave assurances that force wouldn't be contemplated. His own presumption was that patient diplomacy alone would bring this about in time. On the 10th of September 1926, Germany was accepted into the League of Nations as a permanent member of the Council. Stresemann spoke of Germany's place alongside former enemies, denoting the potential for a new direction for mankind. Chamberlain saw it as the end of the war chapter and a fresh start for Europe. Briand was the one who provided the effusive rhetoric. Away with the rifles, machine guns, cannon. Clear the way for conciliation, arbitration, peace, he declared. 2 years later, Briand, his idealism undimmed, was to instigate, together with the American Secretary of State, Frank B. Kellogg, the singularly vacuous Briand-Kellogg Pact, renouncing war as an instrument of national policy and a means of settling international disputes, a dead letter from the moment it was signed. The heady spirit of Locarno soon sobered up. The gap between French and German interests remained wide, once the euphoria dissipated. French security fears weren't easy to overcome. Correspondingly, German hopes of an early end to the foreign occupation of the entire Rhineland swiftly evaporated, though Allied troops left the Cologne zone in 1926. A proposal in 1926 to purchase the attainment of German goals by marketing railway bonds deposited with the Reparations Commission and worth 1.5 million gold marks came to nothing. Germany had pressed for evacuation of the Rhineland, where 60,000 Allied troops were garrisoned on German soil. Return of the Tsar and Eupen Malmedy to Germany, and removal of the Inter-Allied Military Control Commission. But the French saw little or no gain from a greater security risk, although Allied supervision of the German disarmament was, in fact, handed over to the League of Nations in 1927. Moreover, American bankers opposed the commercialization of obligations under the Dawes Plan. At a League of Nations meeting 2 years later, in 1928, Germany formally demanded the evacuation of the Rhineland, this time offering nothing in return. France and Britain, predictably unimpressed, insisted that the Rhineland question be bracketed with finally resolving the reparations issue. By this time, reparations were once more becoming a prominent concern, since German repayment installments under the Dawes Plan were set to rise in 1928-29, and so would present an increased burden on the German economy. a new reparations committee, headed by the American businessman Owen D. Young, began work in January 1929 on a revised framework of regulation. Its recommendations, presented 5 months later, were accepted by the governments involved in August that year. Under the Young plan, Germany would have to pay significantly less, especially in the early years, than under the Dawes plan. But the burden would be lengthy. The last installment would be due only in 1988. The outraged nationalist right in Germany organized a petition to reject the Young plan and forced a referendum on the issue. But when this was held in December 1929, 6 out of 7 voters supported acceptance. Stresemann, though he didn't live to see the referendum, had favoured the plan since it meant the attainment of one of his immediate goals. The Allies undertook to evacuate the Rhineland if Germany accepted it. The German Parliament ratified the Young plan in March 1930, and on the 30th of June that year the Allies pulled their troops out, 5 years earlier than stipulated under the Versailles Treaty. By then, Stresemann, the architect of peaceful revisionism, was dead. He had achieved much in a short time, although he didn't live to see the fruits of all his efforts: the ending of the Ruhr occupation, the end of supervision by the Allied Military Commission, the stabilization of the economy, the regulation of reparations, and the early evacuation of the Rhineland, quite apart from the Locarno Treaty and German entry into the League of Nations. But he had long been suffering from serious health problems, exacerbated by his exhausting diplomatic efforts. With the clouds gathering over Germany and economic crisis about to sweep across the European continent, Stresemann's death was a serious blow to the chances of continuing along the path that he had laid out, one of compromise, caution, and negotiated restoration of German power. The loss was compounded by Briand's declining influence. Following what was widely interpreted in France as his weakness in the negotiations to expedite the evacuation of the Rhineland, and his perceived inadequate defence of French security interests, Briand had been the French premier a record 11 times. In this, his last term, a position he had held only since July, as well as being foreign minister, he left office within a month of Stresemann's death. The Hague Conference in August 1929, which had met to reach agreement on the reparations and the evacuation of the Rhineland, bore the title "The Conference on the Liquidation of the War." It sounded like the commencement of a bright new future. In fact, 1929 proved to be the exact halfway point between the two vast conflagrations that shaped Europe's modern history. Faltering democracies. The calming of international relations from the mid-1920s onwards had been brought about by democratic governments. As long as they survived, there were fair prospects for peace in Europe. But the years of economic recovery in the mid and later 1920s didn't result in a general strengthening of democracy throughout Europe. Some democracies were already giving way to authoritarian regimes. This was more likely in backward agrarian societies with shallow democratic roots, which had deep ideological fissures or faced major problems of national integration. Only in northern and western Europe did democracy remain strong. Across the continent, the picture was checkered. In central Europe, democracy existed merely as a facade in Hungary and faced serious internal difficulties in Austria, but survived well in Czechoslovakia. In Hungary, political parties, elections, with a highly restricted franchise, without secret balloting outside urban areas, and a parliamentary system continued in existence. But the system was pluralist in appearance rather than substance. It was controlled from above by a strong executive, supported by an unchallenged governing party that represented largely elite interests and was aided by much popular apathy and a politically emasculated working class. Austria's democracy remained intact, though its foundations were insecure and its problems daunting. There was little common ground between social democrats and the dominant Christian socialists, who, usually backed by the right-wing pan-Germans, controlled the national parliament, though not the capital of Vienna, throughout the 1920s. The unbridgeable ideological gulf grew, rather than diminished, in the years of stabilization. A flashpoint occurred in 1927, when two members of the Social Democrat Republican Defence League were shot dead by the right-wing Home Defence, and the perpetrators were then acquitted in court. A working-class crowd burnt down the Courts of Justice building in Vienna. The police fired on stone-throwing demonstrators, killing 85 and suffering 4 dead themselves. Hundreds more were injured. An uneasy calm returned, but the main profiteers were the right-wing Home Defence organisation, which gained both new supporters and increased financial backing from industrialists. Ominously, too, the German nationalists were gaining support. The political fronts were becoming radicalized. Economic crisis, when it hit in 1930, struck a democracy built on shaky ground. In contrast, Czechoslovakia overcame ethnic divisions and fragmentation of its party structure to defy the trend and sustain democratic rule without serious threat. The Czech lands, though not Slovakia, were industrially well developed. There was a large, well-educated bourgeoisie and an experienced civil administration. The threat of communism, the Communist Party won almost 14% of the vote in 1925, an election contested by 27 parties and more seats than any other party, was a unifying factor across the remainder of the political spectrum. Whatever their divisions, the major parties, apart from the communists, supported the democracy. It proved possible to build functioning coalitions whose vested interest in making democratic government work was enhanced by strong economic growth from 1923 onwards and a sharp fall in unemployment. The hard-won and still fragile national unity of Czechoslovakia depended on internal stability, which also assisted the readiness of the political parties to sustain the democratic system, while conciliatory noises towards conceding greater autonomy to the large German minority and the Slovaks diffused potential opposition in those constituencies. Czechoslovakia was a rare success story. But already before the onset of the Great Depression, in much of Eastern Europe, in the Balkans, and across the Mediterranean as far as the Atlantic, democracy had collapsed, was collapsing, or was struggling. In Poland, the hero of Polish independence, Marshal Piłsudski, out of patience with the inadequacy of successive administrations to bring stability to a country facing daunting problems, launched a coup d'état on the 12th to the 14th of May 1926, and over the following years took Poland increasingly towards authoritarianism. Integration within a short time of a country that had had 6 currencies, 3 legal codes, 2 railway gauges, a plethora of political parties and sizable ethnic minorities, each facing heavy discrimination, was as good as impossible. The economy was recovering after the hyperinflation of 1922-23, the introduction of a single currency, the zloty, in 1924 was a major step forward, but the country was still facing serious problems, exacerbated by a tariff war with Germany, made all the harder to surmount by a permanent political crisis. Land redistribution was, more than any other issue, politically divisive. Governments had come and gone in short succession. By 1926, with neither political nor economic improvement in sight, and government effectively stalemated by unresolvable parliamentary differences, Piłsudski had had enough. Gathering support from parts of the army that had remained loyal to him, and following a short military struggle in Warsaw, he forced the resignation of the government. The trappings of constitutional government continued in existence, but restrictions on democratic freedoms were increased and authoritarianism was extended, including mounting repression against political opposition. Similar structural conditions to those that brought authoritarianism to Poland, serious problems in a predominantly agrarian economy, tension over the land question, unbridgeable party political divides, sizable ethnic minorities, unattainable national integration, and a powerful military, bedeviled the chances of establishing secure democracy across much of Eastern Europe. In Lithuania, the collapse into authoritarianism didn't take long to materialize. The Lithuanian military, defeated by Piłsudski's army in 1920, but now inspired by his coup in neighboring Poland, instigated a push in December 1926, which led to a decade-long suspension of parliament and a concentration of power in the hands of the president. Elsewhere in the Baltic, in Latvia and Estonia and Finland, parliamentary systems, despite internal instability, managed to hold out against authoritarian pressures from left and right, though only Finnish democracy proved capable of lasting survival. In the Balkans, clientelist politics and raw violence invariably went hand in hand behind the semblance of representative government. Corruption was rife. Political rivalries often mirrored clan hatreds in overwhelmingly poor agrarian countries with high levels of illiteracy. Border and nationality issues contributed to chronic instability. The military usually played a determining role. Greece lurched from monarchy to republic to short-lived military dictatorship and back to a republic between 1923 and 1927, when a third constitution in 3 years was introduced. Thereafter, 4 years of relative stability followed until the drachma lost three-quarters of its value, as economic crisis set in and Greece plunged into a further spiral of disastrous governmental incapacity, before the facade democracy finally collapsed into authoritarianism in 1936. The lawless, violence-ridden Albania could hardly lay claim even to be regarded as a state. Here, the paranoid, vicious Ahmed Zogu, the victor of numerous blood feuds and vendettas, seized power in December 1924 at the head of a military coup. 4 years later, he declared himself King Zog, ruling through patronage backed by armed force, and initiated 14 years of personal dictatorship. In Bulgaria, too, political violence was extreme and endemic. When the Prime Minister, Alexander Stamboliski, was assassinated in 1923 by a group of officers backed by King Boris III, his body was dismembered and his head sent to Sofia in a tin. An attempted communist uprising was then bloodily repressed, the numbers of victims counted in the thousands. Another wave of horrific white terror followed a bomb explosion in Sofia's cathedral in 1925 that left 160 dead and hundreds more badly injured, though the king and his ministers were unscathed. Backed by such repression, a superficial form of parliamentary rule under a dominant government party was stabilized and survived until the Depression years. In Romania, deep tensions revolved around the land question. The bulk of the overwhelmingly rural population were peasant smallholders, and the issue of national identity. The nation was seen to be threatened by the Hungarians' hopes of recovering territory taken from them in the Versailles Treaty, by Bolshevism, though the tiny Communist Party outlawed in 1924 posed only a shadowy threat, and by ethnic minorities, above all Jews. During the 1920s, the tensions were controllable. The new constitution of 1923 bolstered the executive power of the government. Electoral manipulation enabled the ruling Bratianu family to exercise a near monopoly of power, resting on the parliamentary dominance of the National Liberal Party, which they controlled. The death of King Ferdinand in 1927, after a 14-year reign, however, undermined the Bratianu family's hold on power and ushered in political instability. The following year, in the wake of mounting difficulties in the agrarian economy, the National Liberal Party was defeated in elections by the National Peasant Party. Unable to master the economic problems, however, the latter soon lost support. In a bloodless coup in 1930, Karol II, who had been forced in 1925 to renounce his right to the throne because of his part Jewish mistress, reneged on his renunciation and was proclaimed king. The following years would see lasting political crisis amid the rise of a violent, intensely anti-Semitic, fascist movement against the backdrop of severe economic difficulties and the road to eventual dictatorship. In the kingdom of the Serbs, Croats and Slovenes, a shaky construction from the start, the expropriation of major landholders, with compensation and redistribution of land to the peasantry, remained a source of great friction. The country also faced border issues on all sides, towards Italy, Greece, Hungary, and Albania. But the structural problem of trying to reconcile the insoluble competing interests of the Catholic Croatians and the majority Orthodox Serbs was what tipped the unmanageable democracy into authoritarianism. The assassination in Parliament of three Croatian deputies by an uncontrollably outraged Serb in 1928 triggered the move that saw King Alexander dissolve Parliament and suspend the constitution the following January. Press freedom was abolished, political parties were banned, and a more centralized state was introduced. In October 1929, it was given the supposedly unifying name of Yugoslavia, land of the southern Slavs. These steps were cemented in the new authoritarian constitution of September 1931. In the Mediterranean, pluralist parliamentary government had long since been on the defensive or had collapsed altogether. With the Lateran Pacts of 1929, recognizing the sovereignty of the Vatican, regulating relations with the papacy, and reaffirming Catholicism as Italy's state religion, Mussolini consolidated his grip on power over the Italian state by eliminating any potential opposition to his regime from the Catholic Church. The last sphere of relatively autonomous power in the fascist state had been neutralized. In Spain, Primo de Rivera continued the relatively benign dictatorship that he had established in 1923, though he was facing mounting difficulties in holding his flimsy regime together by the time the Depression struck. In 1926, Portugal followed these Mediterranean countries into authoritarian rule. The First World War had destabilized the old oligarchical power structure in Portugal. Chronic governmental instability produced 45 administrations of different types between 1910 and 1926. A military government had taken power for a few months in 1915. A further brief military dictatorship with some proto-fascist traits followed in 1917 to 18. Political violence, never far from the surface of Portuguese politics, became endemic in the early 1920s. The military, though disunited, constituted a potentially insurrectionist force that barely tolerated a dysfunctional pluralist system. A badly organized coup in 1925 was foiled. The following year, Military factions overcame their divisions and civilian government, lacking any fervent support from an apathetic public, offered no resistance to a coup headed by General Gomes da Costa. The conservative elite and the Catholic Church welcomed the coup. The left was too small and too weak to pose any challenge. Costa swiftly gave way to General Antonio Carmona, whose rule rested on military backing. He became president in 1928 and remained in office until his death in 1951. But the key figure was soon to be Antonio de Oliveira Salazar, professor of economics at Coimbra University, appointed finance minister in April 1928, who became prime minister 2 years later. He would be the decisive voice in Portugal's authoritarian regime for 40 years. Only in northern and western Europe, the most economically advanced parts of the continent, was democracy secure in the late 1920s. There, the conditions that went far to undermine democracy in the south and east were absent. Democracy was either already well established or was on the way to firm consolidation in the years of strong economic growth before the Depression. The state rested upon extensive consensus at elite and popular levels, and parties of extreme left and right were marginalized. Whatever the variance, a number of general factors played a part in sustaining democratic legitimacy. The continuity of political and social institutions, despite the turbulence of the war and its aftermath, forms of government that were capable of incorporating the interests of broad sections of society and of making pragmatic adjustments to policy, territorial integrity and cultural homogeneity, and the weakness of communism, which left relatively strong social democracy as the main representation of the working class. National integration in these countries had been, for the most part, a fairly lengthy gradual process. This was the case in Britain, France, Scandinavia, the Low Countries, and Switzerland. The new Irish Free State, comprising the larger southern part of Ireland, was an exception in that it had emerged only after 6 troubled years of the struggle for independence from British rule. Yet, in Southern Ireland too, it quickly proved possible to consolidate a newly created nation-state and a functioning two-party democracy, based in good measure on a homogeneous culture underpinned by deeply ingrained Catholicism and widespread antagonism towards Britain. The failure of democracy in much of Europe had consequences for the population of the countries concerned, sometimes, too, for their near neighbours. But it wasn't likely to threaten the peace of Europe. Such a threat could only come about if democracy were to collapse in one or more of the great powers, Great Britain, France, Germany, whose stability was essential for the continuity of the shaky post-war equilibrium. Britain's economy was in the doldrums for much of the 1920s, yet compared with practically any other country in Europe, it proved a model of political stability. This was despite the fact that its electoral system of majority voting, which militated against fragmentation of parties and formation of coalitions, hadn't prevented 3 changes of government between 1922 and 1924. Ramsay MacDonald, the son of a Scottish farm labourer and housemaid, had defied the social handicap of illegitimacy to rise to the leadership of the Labour Party. In his first of 2 terms as Prime Minister, MacDonald formed a short-lived administration, which lasted from January until November 1924. Government then passed for the next 5 years into the hands of the Conservatives. The new Prime Minister, Stanley Baldwin, from a wealthy Midland steel manufacturing family, cut a solid, reassuring figure. The government had to surmount the social divisions and political turmoil that accompanied the general strike of 1926, and by the following year was on the wane. But crisis in Britain was managed by adjustment within the system. Communism, supported by under 1% of the electorate, and the tiny nascent fascist factions, backed at this point mainly by cranks and eccentrics, could make no impact on mainstream politics. Britain's socio-economic problems in the 1920s were substantial, but they didn't undermine democratic legitimacy. When the Depression heaped a crisis on the minority Labour government of Ramsay MacDonald in 1930-31, there was no crisis of the state. Stability was less assured in France, though democracy faced no serious problems until the Depression years. The rapid turnover of cabinets, six different governments amid the currency crisis between April 1925 and July 1926, didn't call into question the legitimacy of the Third Republic. Stability returned under Ramon Poincaré's premiership between 1926 and 1929, and seemed consolidated by the shift to the conservative right in the 1928 elections. On the surface, all seemed well. In contrast to Britain, however, the political system wasn't uncontested. A sector of French society, influential beyond its still small numbers, had never accepted the Republic or merely tolerated it under sufferance. When the communists, who had lost a good deal of their support, took part, alongside the socialists, in a huge parade in Paris on the 23rd of November 1924 to accompany the transfer of the ashes of the socialist hero Jean Jaurès, assassinated in 1914, to the Pantheon, at a time when France had a left-wing government and was in the throes of a financial crisis, the forest of red flags conjured up the spectre of Bolshevik revolution. It was portrayed by the right as the funeral of the bourgeoisie, when the revolutionary menace became clear to everybody. Within days, a number of patriotic movements, calling themselves leagues of different kinds, one of them, the Faisceau, showing its leanings in its very name, borrowed from Italian fascism, sprang up, recruiting tens of thousands of mainly young Frenchmen almost overnight. Not all of the leagues were fascist. Some, in fact, outrightly rejected the association. And not all of France's extreme right was attracted to the leagues. As elsewhere, the boundaries between the extreme and the conservative right were fluid. The moment passed. Poincaré's stabilizing hand and the sense of restored security for owners of property diffused the crisis. The leagues lost support for the time being. With conservatism dominant, the perceived need for an extreme right diminished. But it hadn't vanished. Given a renewed crisis, more prolonged, more destabilizing, more dangerous, the menace of the extreme right could return in stronger shape to threaten the French Republic. If Britain was solidly stable, and France not much less so, Germany was more enigmatic. It fitted neatly into neither the model of relatively well-established democracies of the more economically advanced northwestern Europe, nor the model of the newly created fragile democracies of eastern Europe. In many ways, Germany was a hybrid. It looked both west and east. It had both an extensive industrial proletariat, like Britain and France, but also a large peasantry, especially in its eastern regions, whose values were rooted in the land. Germany had a long tradition of democratic idealism and pluralistic party politics, a highly developed bureaucracy, a modern industrial economy, and a well-educated, culturally advanced population. But its democratic system was new. It had emerged from the trauma of defeat in the war and revolution, and it was vehemently contested from the outset. Political unity in Germany was still little more than half a century old, and was overlain by a much older sense of cultural identity that stretched far beyond the borders of the nation-state. Unlike Britain, France, and the other countries of northwestern Europe, German nationality was defined by ethnicity, not territory. And Germany's intellectual elites, however varied their views, mainly rejected the values of what they called Western democracy. Whether the French traditions dating back to the Revolution of 1789 or the free trade capitalism and liberalism that had shaped the British development. The German state, as the embodiment of German cultural values, was in their eyes not only different from, but superior to, the products of Western civilization. Germany's national humiliation at the end of the First World War, its post-war economic and military weakness, its loss of status as a great power, and the divisiveness of its parliamentary system were in their minds a temporary disaster, not a permanent state of affairs. Germany's political stability wasn't simply a matter of concern to its own citizens. It was vital to the peaceful future of the European continent. Germany's geographical position, straddling Europe from west to east, its economic and military potential, and its revisionist expectations in Eastern Europe, made the survival of democracy, and with it the continuation of Stresemann's policy of international cooperation, essential if the uneasy equilibrium of power on the European continent was to be sustained. There seemed no undue cause for worry in Germany during the golden years of the later 1920s. There was strong economic growth. Living standards were improving. Germany was now part of the League of Nations. The western borders had been settled at Locarno. Four changes of government between 1925 and 1927 didn't affect the sense that, after the huge upheaval of the early 1920s, democracy was bedding down. The political extremes had lost support. Communist backing had fallen to 9% in 1924, with a corresponding rise in votes for the moderate Social Democrats. The extreme right had fragmented after Hitler's attempted push in November 1923. Although on leaving prison the following year he had refounded his Nazi party, it remained on the outer fringes of politics. In the opinion of one observer in 1927, it was no more than a splinter group incapable of exerting any noticeable influence on the great mass of the population and the course of political events. The general election of 1928 reflected more settled times. The conservative right, much of it half-heartedly democratic at best, lost heavily. That the Nazis were finished as a political force seemed proven by their miserable return of only 2.6% of the popular vote, giving them only 12 seats in Parliament. The chief winners were the Social Democrats, who gained just short of 30% of the votes and were by far the largest party in a grand coalition with the two Catholic and two Liberal parties. Under Hermann Müller, the Social Democrats headed the government for the first time since 1920. Democracy in Germany seemed to face good prospects. Beneath the surface, the situation was less rosy. Müller's coalition was flimsy from the start, with deep divisions soon to surface between the Social Democrats and their unlikely coalition partners, Stresemann's German People's Party, the representatives of big business. The first issue to put the parties at loggerheads was the building of a big warship. The Social Democrats had campaigned before the election with the slogan, "Not armoured cruisers, but food for children." So, when the building of a cruiser was pushed through by ministers from the coalition's centre and right wing, Social Democrats were outraged. The Ruhr industrialists' lockout of almost 250,000 iron and steel workers then caused a further big rift among the coalition partners. And the incompatibility of the coalition's members was fully revealed in a protracted and irreconcilable dispute over the proposal to introduce a small increase in employer contributions to unemployment insurance, the issue that finally brought the unwieldy coalition down in March 1930. By then, economic difficulties were mounting. Unemployment in Germany had reached the 3 million mark in January 1929, up 1 million from the previous year, and accounting for 14% of the working population. The communists, who had increased their support at the polls to over 10% in the 1928 elections, were finding ready backing among many of the unemployed and, following the new Stalinist line adopted by the Comintern, were turning their fire on the Social Democrats, ludicrously vilified as social fascists. In the countryside, the crisis in the agrarian economy was causing a great deal of political disaffection. Somewhat to their own surprise, and without any sustained agitation on their part, the Nazis found that they were garnering considerable support in the countryside of northern and eastern Germany. The party membership had been growing, in fact, even during the years in the political wilderness, and now stood at over 100,000, a good activist basis with which to exploit the growing unrest. The favourable publicity they received in the conservative press for their shrill campaign against the revised reparations scheme presented in the Young Plan also helped their cause. The Nazis, though still far from a mainstream party, increased their share of the vote in a number of regional elections in 1929. The following June, with the Depression now biting, Hitler's party won over 14% of the vote in state elections in Saxony, nearly six times higher than its vote in the 1928 Reichstag election. Shortly afterwards, Müller's successor as Chancellor, the Centre Party politician Heinrich Brüning, dissolved the Reichstag after it had rejected his proposals for swingeing cuts in public expenditure. No attempt was made to find a democratic solution to the financial difficulties. Instead, Brüning sought to push through his deflationary measures by presidential decree. The absolutely crucial position of the Reich president had been held since 1925 by the war hero Field Marshal von Hindenburg. Although sworn to uphold the Democratic Republic, Hindenburg, a pillar of the old monarchist regime, was no democrat, but saw himself rather as a type of Ersatzkaiser. Replacing the Social Democrat Chancellor, Müller, with Brüning, known from soundings to be favourably disposed to governing with the backing of presidential decree, had in fact been planned months earlier as part of a strategy to undermine social democracy and introduce government without parliamentary pluralism. Hindenburg, Brüning, and the conservative elites who backed their move weren't for a moment contemplating a government run by the Nazis, seen as primitive, vulgar, loud-mouthed populists, not the sort to manage the German state. What they wanted was essentially to turn the clock back, with or without the monarchy, to a type of Bismarckian constitutional arrangement in which government was beyond the control of parliament, most of all, beyond the control of the hated Social Democrats. The aim of Hindenburg, Brüning, and the conservative elites was a sort of anti-democratic semi-authoritarianism managed by those elites. With Brüning's accession to the chancellorship and Hindenburg's readiness to bypass parliament, a serious blow had been inflicted to the democratic state in Germany already before the slide into depression. A further major blow followed in the Reichstag election on the 14th of September 1930. Brüning's decision to go to the country backfired spectacularly. Hitler's party achieved an astonishing electoral breakthrough, winning 18.3% of the vote and gaining 107 seats in the new Reichstag. All at once, the Nazis were on the map, now the second largest party in the German parliament. A vote for the Nazis was no longer a wasted ballot for a minor fringe party. Mass support bringing an inflow of funding to engage in further radical agitation, grew rapidly. The bandwagon was rolling. A Hitler chancellorship still seemed a remote possibility, but with the fateful decision to move to rule by presidential decree, and with the election success of the Nazis in 1930, the death knell for German democracy was sounding. And with that, uncertainty in Europe as a whole was bound to be magnified. The uneasy equilibrium of the past few years would be in jeopardy.